This is Technically Legal, a podcast about legal technology, innovation in the legal industry, and the impact tech is having on the law. I'm Chad Main, the founder of legal services company Percipient. Today's show is a conversation about investing and building successful legal tech businesses. I'm talking to Zach Posner of the Legal Tech Fund, which is a VC fund that invests in companies that are reimagining the world of law. This episode is a great episode if you want to learn more about what it takes to build a successful startup. Of course, the main focus is on building a legal tech company, but the information and suggestions are valid for startups in any industry. Today, I'm talking to Zach Posner, who's one of the founders of the Legal Tech Fund, which is an investment fund that focuses on legal tech businesses and other related technologies. The Legal Tech Fund has a pretty solid track record, and if you've listened to more than a few episodes of this podcast, you probably heard from some of the founders that are building businesses in which the Legal Tech Fund is invested. For instance, a couple of episodes ago, I talked to Scott Stevenson from Spellbook. A while back, I had a great conversation with Otto Hansen at Term Scout, and a couple of years ago, I talked with one of Joseph's founders, Tom Dreyfus. The thing they have in common? They're all backed by the Legal Tech Fund. Zach brings a unique blend of experiences and insights to the legal tech world. He's worked in finance, and one of his most successful ventures is when he helped build an education tech company that was ultimately acquired by McGraw-Hill. After that exit, Zach ultimately went on to help co-found the Legal Tech Fund. As we will hear, the fund has three main areas of investing interest: companies that are building tech that harness information from the contracting processes. They're also interested in investing in companies that are working to make legal services available to more people. Zach gives some great real-world insight and advice to those out there trying to build a company, including the importance of frequent reporting to investors, because as he points out, the most successful companies often have the highest frequency of reporting to stakeholders. He also encourages entrepreneurs to be very open and honest about the challenges they're facing because it allows investors to insist in problem solving. As we'll hear, Zach also says it's important for entrepreneurs to demonstrate their products in a quick, iterative manner. He stresses that frequent engagement with customers can provide great insights that can help guide the product development process. Zach also believes that entrepreneurs should be tenacious with their vision, but flexible in their approach of achieving that vision. All right, so let's get to my conversation with Zach Posner. From the get-go, we'll find out that Zach has always been in the business of building businesses. His job right out of college was doing due diligence for business transactions.
Right out of college was PricewaterhouseCoopers. Ended up in a financial due diligence group. So we were helping in and around transactions and either helping buyers, sellers, and specifically in technology, with technology companies. This is right around the 2000-2001 era. You know, what the beauty behind that role was, got to see an extraordinary amount of companies. You know, every 2-3 weeks you're at a new engagement, you get your butt kicked, you stay up all night learning about the business and building operating models, and just an amazing entry point into a career that I actually have to thank Indiana University for, because they had such a good relationship, such an amazing accounting group, such an amazing finance school, and then all the big four were aggressively recruiting from there.
Was your degree from the Kelly School of Business?
It was before it was Kelly, but yes.
Yeah. So you're doing this kind of due diligence stuff, helping transactions, business transactions there. I want to say 2010s, around that time, you get into education tech. You're CEO of a company called Ingrade.
Yep.
What did Ingrade do?
So what we were doing at Ingrade, we were helping teachers manage all of the data in the classroom. And, you know, I'd done a couple other things in between, but, you know, fast forward to Ingrade, we had this vision that you're going to have more and more devices in the classroom, and that one day every kid was going to have their own device. And we thought that the data that would come from those devices and that this kind of like new experience.
When you say device, are we talking iPad, something like that?
iPad or a computer. I mean, I think now you see a lot of these one-to-one initiatives where almost every kid has a device, but we're talking about like 2008, 9, 10, when we were really getting into this, and we were nowhere there. You had a computer lab, or you had, you know, you were pushing a laptop cart down a hallway and the whole school was sharing one set of laptops. But, you know, the vision that we had with, like a lot of others, was that these devices were going to be able to personalize education. And it was going to change a way where right now a teacher has to teach to, you know, the average of the class historically, but every teacher is going to be able to eventually see a data profile of each individual student and what his or her strengths and weaknesses were, and they can personalize learning for each student. And we knew that, you know, there was all these great apps popping up, these different applications, whether traditional or whether through the new marketplaces. But without the data living in a unified place, it didn't matter. You know, it wasn't going to impact education. So we said, what happens if you pull all that data out, you put it into one place, and you use it to improve educational outcomes? And that's what NGRADE was. And it was really, I think, really the first version of a learning management system that was brought down into the K-12 environment that said, you know, you have grades here, you have different assessments with different assessment providers here, you have different formative programs, which, you know, that's the software that teachers use for homework. And how do you bring that all together with a unified profile for a student?
Both my kids are graduates of the Chicago Public Schools. And from the get-go, they were Google. CPS is Google. Did you compete with Google there for that kind of stuff? Or what was the difference in the NGRADE and what Google's doing?
We were before Google, and we were very good friends with Google. You know, as they announced some of their tools into this platform, you know, we were kind of a generation before Google. Google kind of, you know, they had started dabbling in education in probably 2012, 13. I don't think they really got serious for many more years as they started pushing out Chromebooks in a meaningful way. So our software would sit alongside of them. But you know, if you want me to bridge, there was like lots of learnings. And one key learning was we had 12 million kids on our platform. And very few folks asked us about our security practices. And we had all this sensitive data. Every best practice you could, we followed. But we were just surprised that more folks didn't ask the right questions. And it wasn't necessarily about asking us the right questions. It was about asking all the other vendors that were 30 years old.
Yeah.
There were questions. So kind of a light bulb went off there, which I'll come back to later on.
So McGraw-Hill buys NGRADE, correct?
Yeah, they bought us in 2014.
And you move over there?
Sure.
You're still working with the company under McGraw-Hill?
Yeah, so I wasn't really obligated to work with the company, but was actually truly inspired by the leadership team at McGraw-Hill. And I spent... I want to say 3-4 years there, and really learned, you know, I'd done a lot of stuff in the earlier stage world, done a lot of stuff in my career in the investing world and the finance side, but this was the first time that I'd seen, you know, how you operate a company at scale, how companies internally think about M&A, how companies internally think about transformation, and spectacular experience because of spectacular people and mentors all around me.
And then pretty shortly after you leave McGraw-Hill, you get into legal tech. How does that work? You go from education tech to legal tech. What was the connection, that, if anything, there, the jump?
Remember that light bulb that I told you about a second ago? Nobody asked us about security. So sometime right after the transaction, I kind of helped a friend get a business started. And what the business was going to do was bend the risk for K-12 education. So we were going to help school districts. This business was going to help school districts look at all their vendors and make sure they were holding data securely.
That came from the part you just talked about, the security. People weren't asking the questions. That's where the idea came from?
That's where it came from. Exactly, trying to solve that pain point, say, school districts. And we went to council to form the company. And council is a top 2 or 3 tech law firm in the world. And they basically said to us on the first day, forget about schools. We need this as a law firm. We are using all of these vendors. We are storing our client information on these vendors. And in its most simplistic form, if we use Dropbox and Dropbox gets hacked, we have a problem. And so we need to make sure Dropbox is secure. So that company on the first day pivoted to serve law firms. The numbers are slipping my mind because this was back in 2014 or 15, but we quickly, I want to say, picked up half the top 10 law firms. And then it grew kind of aggressively. And what this company did was it was seeing every vendor in a law firm. And the more that we were watching these trends, the more we were paying attention to the vendors and saying, and the more we spoke to these vendors, we realized they were all struggling on the capital side because there's no capital partners dedicated to legal and nobody really understands the space. And everybody thinks it's a horrible space and it's a small market and the end customers are good to work with. But we had seen like a lot of pattern matching with that in kind of K-12 education. And we actually thought the opposite. You know, we thought that if you could show somebody an improved user experience And yes, the sales cycle may be a little bit prolonged in legal, but once you get through that and the end user starts changing their habits, we think it's an amazing customer that sticks with you for many years. So that was kind of the journey into legal that started out with some angel investments, you know, that was really thinking directionally from 2015 to 2020. And that kind of led up to the fund.
So from that point, then you start to go out and raise money for the fund and you're going to focus on these legal tech companies. Was that the plan?
We kept seeing more and more companies. Entrepreneurs kept referring us to more and more as we were able to talk to entrepreneurs. And I mean, it was literally, it's little things. Like we cover, you know, now we've expanded significantly and our kind of footprint is the intersection, you know, of legal with like lots of other verticals. But even when you just talk about the hardcore legal stuff that sells into law firms, there's a big difference if you're selling to a big law firm versus a small law firm. There's a massive difference in a sales and a go-to-market process if you're selling to a corporate firm versus a contingency firm. There's a huge implementation difference between a corporate firm and a contingency. And just like understanding these and being able to have these types of conversations, we realized the entrepreneurs were just, you know, extraordinarily grateful that there's an investor that's thinking about this stuff.
You said you kind of tweaked, your focus has slightly changed. You're not just legal tech as we think about it, it's kind of some tertiary stuff you're working in. Did you guys change your thinking about that because of it? It's sometimes hard to sell into legal, or what facilitated the change there?
No, because the thing that was on the back of our mind since day one was there's a company called Carta, and thinking through Carta was a big thesis for the fund that said, hey, most people think Carta is a fintech company, but we would say at its core, they manage cap tables. And if you look at who used to manage cap tables before Carta, it was attorneys. And attorneys administered the cap table, but attorneys are not the ones that are buying the product. They act as a distribution partner. So we started to think about the world as almost like a pyramid where up top you have software that sells into law firms and you can say that goes with the business of law and then that goes with the practice of law. Then you get into software that sells into clients and that can start into a general counsel. Then that can go into legal ops. Then that also goes into business units. Then you can keep going and say there's a whole SMB segment. And then you can go all the way down to the consumer. So if you look at something like Carta, they sold into businesses. What's so fascinating about Carta is, you know, that's mid-level in that pyramid I just described, but it changes everybody's role and responsibility upstream. So a business using Carta changes the role of the general counsel. It also changes the role of the law firm. It also changes the business of law, where that may have been a business unit that is no longer. So that's the type of stuff that when we think about legal, we think of that entire pyramid and we think about how a company like DocuSign, you know, that a consumer may sign a doc may even have affected what a paralegal does all the way upstream. And what that means is we end up touching companies, you know, probably I haven't done the exact numbers, but at more than half of our portfolio would not identify themselves as a legal company. They would identify themselves as a fintech company or a prop tech company, but it's all about that legal work or interact, you know, or changing that those roles and responsibilities that we described.
Seems like the companies you're most interested in, and for good reason, need kind of to bleed over and have more appeal than just selling into legal. They've got to have a use case maybe for those.
It's all of the above. Our portfolio is like evenly distributed between those buckets, between selling to law firms, selling into corporates, and selling to consumers and SMBs. You know, some of the our strongest companies in our portfolio are selling directly to law firms, doing things everybody else would kind of say, that's not interesting. You know, like, I tell a lot of the companies, I have this joke where I'm like, oh, wow, like what you guys are doing is really sexy. It's never sexy. Like, nothing that we do is like, you know. But the flip side is, you know, you can build some spectacular businesses and things that are not sexy.
When we come back, Zach fills us in on the types of companies that the Legal Tech Fund likes to invest in. He explains why the most successful companies send out frequent updates to investors and why it's important to get as much customer feedback as possible. I'm Chad Main, and you're listening to Technically Legal.
We need to do more with less. That is the key takeaway nowadays from almost every survey of in-house counsel. But what if it didn't have to be that way? What if you actually could do more for less? By combining legal expertise and technology, Percipient enables legal teams to get more work done for less. Buried in contracts and sales is frustrated with turnaround time? We can help with that. Did you just get hit with a subpoena and reviewing 100,000 documents and files will tax your resources or cost you a small fortune in billable hours? We can help there too. Our team of legal professionals leverage tech and project management principles with the right amount of human oversight to deliver precise, efficient, and cost-effective legal solutions. Whether it's legal operations and contract management support, subpoena compliance, or document review, Percipient is your partner in really doing more for less. Percipient. Legal services powered by technology.
We'll get back to my conversation with Zach Posner in just a second, but before I do, like I always do, I want to direct you to tlpodcast.com. At that web address, you'll find an episode page for this episode and all other past episodes of Technically Legal. On those pages, you'll find more information about our guests and links to some of the stuff we talk about. If you want to get a hold of me, you can email me at cmain@percipient.co. That's cmain@percipient.co, or find me on LinkedIn or X. All right, let's get back to my conversation with Zach Posner of the Legal Tech Fund.
I want to get to your investing thesis because you've got three kind of buckets on your website, on your LinkedIn. But I should just point out that you have some great companies. Many have been on the podcast. We've had Otto from Term Scout, Tom from Joseph. We just had Scott from Spellbook on there. So there's a lot of cool companies. So let's talk about that. It looks like the Legal Tech Fund is interested. I'm sure they're interested in a lot of stuff, but the kind of main focus right now, it seems, according to the website, is what you call rethinking agreements. Companies that are building a product that can grab data out of contracts, the day-to-day contracts in the business. Secondly, companies that are helping facilitate access to justice, because legal help is expensive and it is cost prohibitive to majority of society sometimes when they need it. And then third, governance. You know, I think I saw on your LinkedIn bio, under this bucket is, I think, Web3 and beyond. So I want to talk about all three of these. Let's start with the contracts. You know, when contract software, the first thing that comes to mind is like contract lifecycle management or AI to edit the contracts like Spellbook. But what else interests you? What are we not thinking about? Because those are the two kind of most obvious types of business. What are you seeing out there in this bucket of grabbing data from contracts to use in many ways?
So I'll go at a high level. At a high level, I have this belief, you know, everything that we do personally and professionally starts with some sort of agreement. Why doesn't all of the software that's involved with governing that agreement in any capacity start with like the legal tech world? You know, where the earlier that data is structured, the more things you can do with that data downstream. First legal doc that we ever get is a birth certificate. Why isn't that data structured? Like, how many times do you enter in your birthday somewhere? But, you know, if you think about an agreement that says parties will do this, and, you know, first off, the negotiation of it back and forth on average costs $7,000 for an agreement, which is just absolutely insane. And so you say, why don't we take that down? Because what do you, you know, what do people really think about? They think about 5 or 10 terms, and there's usually a finite outcome for those terms, 2 or 3 things. Why isn't AI,
Term Scout. They use Term Scout.
Term Scout. We have another company called the Contract Network. Like, oh, why are people using these tools to negotiate these agreements a lot faster? Then once the agreement's negotiated, and if it's negotiated in Term Scout and Contract Network and one of these tools, everything's structured. So somehow an API can be sent to some financial system that says, generate an invoice because there's a $5,000 payment up front as part of this agreement. You know, and then the wire instructions can, you know, you can extrapolate that out and see how all of this stuff can be automated. I think that's the opportunity with agreements. And what we're really looking for, and this cuts across everything, you know, all the three different areas you just discussed, is like we're looking for evidence that people like really care about the software. And that happens in lots of different ways, depending upon the stage of a company. You know, in the beginning, it may be like, hey, 10 people say that's a good idea. You know, then that may move to, hey, here's a wireframe. You know, will you sign an LOI if we build this that you will give it a pilot? Then that will go to pilots. Then that will go to what is the engagement on the pilot? Then that will go to do people sign up and be a customer? Then how often do they log in? Then do they renew or expand? So it's like, that's what we're looking for. The better the user experiences, the quicker that all those things happen. And in some cases, that's a really broad user experience. You know, like any of these companies you mentioned, like Scott at Spellbook, like, or in some cases, hey, we recently invested in a company that is just helping contractors in the construction process manage their subcontractors. So that's a very different right. experience and what those that agreement looks like and how that gets built. But again, the underlying thread here is, does this software need to be there? Does this matter? Is this changing people's lives? How would you feel if that software disappeared? I always say to people like, hey, think about your, like, what do you use personally for email? Do you use
Gmail? I'm a Gmail guy, yeah, Google, yep.
And how long have you been using Gmail?
So I was actually a beta tester, believe it or not. So that was, I want to say, four-ish maybe, right?
So my guess is you have a lot of emails in there. You probably have things like your tax returns and all this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if I took away your Gmail from you right now, how would you feel?
I can't function. I mean, that's, you know.
That's the holy grail of software.
Yeah.
Because if Google came back to you and said, you know, that's kind of what you're, that's what we're looking for.
Yeah.
And that's the underlying thread that cuts across every company that we're talking to and every investment that we make.
Let's talk about the second bucket, because you're talking about software that you can't live without. The second bucket is a little bit different because it's software we need that maybe not exist. The way you guys describe it is you want to look at companies that use technology to make legal services available to all, the access to justice issue. So the question I want to start with, though, is what is the reason access to justice is hard? It's because it's expensive. People don't think they can make money providing access to these types of legal services. So if you're encouraging an entrepreneur to go into this area, and they come back at you and say, well, why do I want to do that? There's no money to be made, because if there was, somebody would be doing it. What do you tell them? Why do you tell them that's not true? Why did you make a company like this?
So I want to do a couple of things. One, bifurcate the discussion from and move away that concept of access to justice.
Okay.
I think that's like a really different cohort of companies and problems. And I think of that as like, chances to say companies we invest in are not going to help somebody that's wrongly accused of murder get out of jail. Well, where I want to focus it is like this access to legal services.
Okay.
And we like very carefully, some people use the justice term, but I kind of bifurcate in a big way.
You know, I never thought about that, because that's a significant distinction, because justice is one thing. Legal services, you know, day-to-day transactional stuff is different. I've never really thought about that fully.
And this next concept kind of cuts across both. But, you know, there is this concept that says, hey, the average attorney rate in this country, and this may be a year too old, is $364 an hour. The median wage is $19 an hour. So you just do that math. Like, nobody can afford a lawyer. Like, forget justice. People have, like, legal issues that they could use help with. That's where we think there's just so much opportunity. And I look at it as just saying, hey, even for people that have done well and may be able to access attorneys, like, you know, if you're, some of these attorneys are about $2,000 an hour, like there's only so many hours before it would take anybody. So that's kind of the hope and the promise that technology can do. We have found that there's not a trade-off. At the end of the day, legal services are probably only available to 1% of the people in this country. And we say technology can be used to help lots of folks. You know, it's not a zero-sum game. These are markets that don't exist right now because nobody's there to serve them. We have a company, you know, it was one of our first investments, a company called SoloSuit. And what SoloSuit does is when somebody gets sued by a debt collector for $1,000, there's no lawyer that wants that case. You every lawyer in the world. Like, there's nobody.
That's a real significant need. There's a lot of research about this type of litigation. They all default. They generally default.
We could spend an hour.
Right.
But the takeaway is this software helps you for, you know, and it kind of productizes an experience where it helps the user fill out their own response and then file that response for directionally $100. There are a lot of people that could use it. And then, by the way, we'll also put you in touch with an attorney if you'd like one for something in the realm of another $100, because these are very specific things that the attorney understands very well and can move through in rapid order. So yes, you can't take on a case like this and spend months for $100. But when the user is already aware of the issues and has already prepared their own documentation, well, these things become very quick. Like, that's the type of company that we see that's just been growing every month, you know, has the potential to be a very big company, and at the same time, help a lot of people. But I'd also take this back to another example that may, you know, is when you started your company, you may have bought, or when I started some of my companies, I may have gone to counsel, and that may have been a $5,000-$10,000 project, you know, where at the end of the day, you're forming a corporation that I think the state of Delaware charges $300 right. for it. And maybe there's a Q&A process where this should be a couple $100, but the difference between $500 and $10,000 may be a barrier for somebody from starting a business. So this access to legal services, it's not, you know, we bifurcate it from justice because your mind goes to a certain place, but it's for everybody. It feels like most of the stuff that we're looking at, it's not a zero-sum game. It's just like, it's not available right now. We're expanding the markets. And I think that that's a whole theme for everything that we do, even the stuff that sells into law firms, you know, software that can help them be 30% more efficient, you know, at the end of the day, leads to reduced legal bills.
Well, it doesn't, does it? You hope, in theory.
In theory. But the takeaways that we have seen is like, most law firms are welcoming of this stuff. They want to bill their clients for a thought partner type of work that's high level. They don't want to have to bill them for organizing papers and building closing binders after a transaction is done.
Right. You answered my question there too. As I started this whole talk about these access to legal services companies is, you know, what would you tell the entrepreneur? And you said something interesting there. They can make money. They can't pay $324 an hour, but they can maybe pay $100. So there is a market. There is money to be made in this area. That's, you know, that's kind of the answer to the entrepreneur that is reticent about looking at creating that kind of business, right?
There's companies like RocketWire. They're right? doing hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue. The same thing with like a LegalZoom. I mean, there's massive opportunities here.
Yep. So this third bucket, tell me about it. Governance. You say, think Web3 and beyond. What's in this bucket? What are you looking for in a company?
At the end of the day, the underpinning theme of Web3 is the concept of a smart contract. A smart contract goes back to some of that stuff that blends in with what we discuss with agreements, you know, where things kind of automatically happen. So there's lots of data points that say this could be the next generation of legal. You know, in fact, we invested in a company, it's a smart contract auditor. And what they're doing is they're looking at those smart contracts to making sure there's not holes in them. Because if there's holes, that's how hacks happen. And, you know, you hear about all these.
They're looking at it from a technological aspect and or a legal aspect, both are tech, security.
Technological, touch of the legal. But at the end of the day, well, like right now you send your agreement to an attorney and they're there to see if there's any holes in that agreement. A smart contract, you send that to a smart contract auditor. So that could look like the future role of an attorney to some extent. So anyway, there's just lots of crossover with the Web3 world. And we're excited about it.
I think I saw this in a LinkedIn post you had, which I encourage people to follow you on LinkedIn because you offer some succinct, helpful, real-world advice about raising money, building businesses and stuff, and it's helpful. But one of the things, and this is specific to legal, and I want to talk to you about it. You say, if there's one thing I could change about the legal tech industry, it's create or encourage easier ways for software demos. We all need to interact with your products with ease. Is it just a demo, or are you saying also that legal tech products historically have been hard to use? Because I'm of that belief, too.
I believe it's a demo because I believe you're seeing a new cycle of just user experiences that trump anything that's ever existed. And I think there's a massive discovery challenge in and around legal where there's a lot of noise and there's a lot of software that like blends together. So because of that, what we encourage our entrepreneurs to do is just show the software as quick as possible. Don't talk. Don't explain why your software is so amazing. Just show it because it's either going to click or it's not with somebody. And if it doesn't, that's like, that's the learnings as to what the
right.
types of things you
No, when you say it doesn't click, it's, is it because the software itself the UX maybe needs some tweaks because it's complicated, or it just doesn't click with that person because they don't think they have the need for it.
They're probably interrelated, right? If the UX isn't great, they don't think they have the need. But like, I just look at it and say, like, we see some amazing things, and they struggle with distribution, and it's because they struggle to get in front of people, which is something that we try to help with. But that's where that came from. Like, I just think that if more people saw stuff, they would be more eager to try something, and then that would lead to more adoption technology.
You alluded to it before that sometimes selling into legal could be difficult. Sales cycles are long. Lawyers are their own kind of breed, and tech isn't always in the forefront of what they're thinking about. But so it leads me to a question. Should there be a different way of thinking if I'm an entrepreneur creating a legal tech company versus some other B2B type of company? Is legal tech as an industry different from any other software B2B type of product building industry?
It is different, and primarily around the sales cycle and understanding like what that looks like in each different segment. There's also a less of a reluctancy to try things. You know, you do have other concerns in legal that are much more heightened, you know, confidentiality, because you have, you know, attorney-client privilege, you know, you have a client's secrets that you so there's a little bit less of a risk appetite. So that means you have to construct pilots, you have to get people to like interact with your software. I would just say in general, it's different. It's probably different in almost, and by the way, with large language models, like we're seeing it, and really Goldman Sachs put out a report that said, I think legal is the number one vertical susceptible for AI. And because of that, we've seen an extraordinary influx of entrepreneurs coming in from other verticals or just technology entrepreneurs. And they're building some amazing things, but they're not truly paying attention to what the customer needs, what that end user experience is. And a lot of them are struggling with adoption right now.
Right. So what is the advice you give to an entrepreneur, knowing that legal's got its own kind of idiosyncrasies? Any advice you give them? How do you encourage them to think?
Get in front of as many customers as you can as quickly as possible and have very short iterative cycles where, like, if you get there, you show something to somebody, they don't like it, they give you this feedback and they're going to go that way. Well, don't wait 6 months before showing them again. Like, just keep iterating with folks and, you know, until people start grabbing the software from you.
So speaking of LinkedIn, you had another great post. In the post, you said, last week, a founder asked me, what are the best questions entrepreneurs should ask potential investors? And you gave a list of ones you liked. And there are several, and I want to go over a couple, but what's an example of a good founder-investor relationship, and what's an example of a bad one?
All of the questions that were quoted there, they all come down to like a trusting relationship back and forth. And that comes out, I've been on that side of the table for longer than I've been on this side of the table. You know, entrepreneurs are usually trying to put on a show for venture funds, and they try to brush the bad news or the risks kind of like under the table. And what we found is like the folks that are the most open and honest throughout the process about the challenges, like, yes, you negotiate when you're getting in a business together, but the minute that happens, like, you're on the same side of the table. Any one of our companies has a problem, like, we have a problem. And there's not, like, we are fully aligned from that point forward. And entrepreneurs are always trying to paint a rosy picture because they're trying to maximize valuation or things along those lines. But, you know, the ones that I think the best relationships that I've seen are the ones where just there's nobody's posturing. Nobody's like, everybody's just like, open with the status of things. And look, every company we go into, there's like, there's more unknowns than knowns. And it's just like, you're going to be on the same team. Why not, like, you know, surprises kind of stink. When you're misled in the process, it kind of stinks when you're, and those are the things that I think all have the capacity to like sour a relationship versus, hey, what are your three real concerns? You know what I mean? And hey, we're concerned our biggest customer is going to churn. Great. Can we dive into that and say, what can, you know, here's 10 things that we've seen that you could be doing and we could be trying to avoid that. But now if in 6 months that customer churns, we're on board. Like, there's not, oh yeah, we're, you know what I mean? So I think that's what it all comes down to.
Which is a good segue into another question you like, or would encourage entrepreneurs to ask potential investors is, what are your expectations, you as a potential investor, for involvement in reporting? So let me ask you that. What do you expect from your companies, your involvement to be, and what kind of reporting do you like?
So we just onboarded a company yesterday. And part of onboarding, we have a whole list of things, all the best practices. Here's the different people you should talk to. Here's, have you thought about this? There's a lot of things founders haven't thought about before they kind of take any money. And we're like, but they become really important in the next couple of months. So we try to get them all out there so they're aware of it and they can think about these things. One of them is reporting. And I think I caveated the whole conversation to the founder with, hey, I'm going to tell you what we've seen is best practices and what we think really works. But at the end of the day, this is like your company. You know, we are always a minority. You can do whatever you want. You know, there's two pieces of research that came out that said the number one characteristic of the most successful companies in the world is the frequency of their reporting out to their important stakeholders. And what reporting does is whatever that cadence is, that's how their cycles become evolved. So if you are working for an annual meeting, you know, if you're a big public, like my guess is that's how you think of your cycles. You think of it as, oh, by next year's annual meeting, we want to do this with this. If you have a quarterly board meeting, right about now, you're like, oh, we have 15 days to get it in on this quarter. So we have our meeting in April. We're able to say we achieved our goals. Now take that back to monthly. Now take that back to 2 weeks. Now take that back to a week. The earlier stage company you are, the more the days matter.
Right.
I have personally always liked, and I have always followed a weekly cadence in all of my companies that I've operated. And what that does is that makes the entrepreneur and their entire team stop every Friday and say, how are we doing? And you're going to have a lot of misses. But the difference between realizing that you didn't get something done this week and approaching it again on Monday versus not realizing it for a month or a quarter. I was speaking to a top person at WeWork. My question for them was, the thing that's most impressive to me is like, you guys every month were opening like offices in like 15 different countries. Every month you were doing builds and like chat. Like when you want to move an office, it's probably like a 3 month experience for you. So imagine like every, and I said, how did you do that? And they said, look, most companies think in year cycles. We thought in 2 week cycles. At the end of this 2 weeks, that's our year. We're reporting out what happened, what we got right, what we got wrong, what we need to do next year. So you can imagine how much more you get done when you just stop and pause. So we encourage our entrepreneurs. And then the other thing is, imagine, you know, every one of our companies has 25 people that really care about the outcome. You know, those can be the investors, those can be advisors, those can be. So imagine you get a note every week. You know, we have 50 companies. Well, when I get a note every week from companies, I stop, I read the note, I think about what we can do to help that company. And if I don't get that note that week, I don't think about that company. And then the other thing, Jet, like I've seen this happen and it's amazing. Like you don't know who my roommate was at Indiana. And it turns out that you're looking to do something with Pepsi and he or she is the, so it's like you just never know people's tentacles and everybody on that email is there to help advance the company.
Yeah.
So I'm a big believer in it. A lot of people say, oh, this is too much. But
you're not asking for, you know, the quarterly reports, annual reports. You're just asking for some down and dirty reports. Yeah.
10 bullets. Here's the biggest thing. You message out bad news early. Imagine getting to a board meeting on a quarterly basis and finding out something big happened to that company. It changes the tenor of the board meetings where, you know, when somebody walks in and they're not prepared and they're like, wait, what do you mean you lost this customer? Did you not read that email? Like I emailed you 24 hours on the Friday email after it happened. So for us, what we focus on, I gave examples of Carta and DocuSign being amazing companies. And when we started this, we said, hey, not only do we want to understand this vertical, But we want to bring together all of the impactful people in this vertical that can help our companies to succeed. They're both examples of actually investors in our fund, along with some of the top law firms in the world that have invested with us. And then besides that, we kind of take lots of people's phone calls. On any given day, we're talking to chairs and heads of innovations at law firms. We're talking to general counsels, heads of legal ops. And what we are trying to do is just bring together as many advisors as we possibly can to A, help advance our companies, but B, help advance the entire community. And that concept of like seeing more demos, like that's what we're really trying to do. Like when we see in some cases north of 50 companies on a monthly basis, and we know that Coca-Cola is trying to look for companies that can help them in X, Y, and Z, and we're able to make some of those introductions. And that's where this stuff all comes together. And that's really what we're trying to do as a fund, not only for our companies, but for the entire community, because that's kind of the role that we play, why we started an event, et cetera.
The last question on your list of questions you like to get from entrepreneurs when you're potentially thinking about investing in a company is, what do you see consistently in successful companies you've funded? What have you seen? And we touch a lot on reporting, but beyond, you know, consistent reporting and things like that, but what else have you seen?
There's kind of a company building side, which is characteristics like reporting, like does the founder or is there know-how internally that really understands unit economics, understands an operating model, understands, you know, how to manage cash needs and cash requirements with what their plans are. And then there's the kind of product side, like, is there a real product market fit? And if not, are they continuously iterating to get there? A lot of entrepreneurs just kind of like bury their head in the ground and build the vision that they have. But it's like, you need to be, my partner says a line, like stubborn with your vision, but flexible as to how you get there. You know, if you're only picking your head up every couple months, you're burning a lot of cash in that process. Who knows if it's right or wrong versus some of the companies that are constantly out there working with customers, working with folks. So I think that you got to get the company building right. You got to get the product right. And when those two things come together, you see some good things.
Zach, appreciate your time. If people want to get a hold of you, where do you want to send them?
LegalTech.com or find me on LinkedIn.
Okay, that's a wrap for today's episode. As always, we really appreciate you listening. If you want to subscribe, you can find us on most major podcast platforms like Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, etc. Also, if you like us enough, I hope you leave us a favorable review. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this has been Technically Legal.